dosti vardına.
My name is Ugyen Tsering. I'm currently the Foreign Secretary of the Federal Government of Bhutan.
I'm Ruth Feinhoven. I'm a sociologist and I study happiness.
Karma Ura. I work as a researcher for the Center of Bhutan Studies, located in Thimphu, the capital of Bhutan.
I'm Yob Diong. At the moment, I'm director of the Transcultural Psychosocial Organization, and I'm a professor of public health and culture at the Free University.
I'm Sander Tiedemann. My profession is development banking, and I had the privilege of working in Buddhist communities in Asia for quite some time.
I'm trained in economic law, and of course, we know the concept of gross national product. The concept of gross national happiness is of a different order. I understand it's a very nice parameter, very nice concept. Maybe you can explain a little bit more what it means in Bhutan.
In the 60s, when we had to start getting into moving ahead with development, it was important to us to try to see under what terms we are moving ahead. It became necessary for Bhutan to start modernizing. The world around us had changed. These sort of the regional complexities had reached a situation that Bhutan could not be isolated any longer. So the objective and or the philosophy of development that was adopted by Bhutan was based on certain Buddhist principles, one of compassion, one of balance, on trying to preserve not only the balance in terms of one's life, but also in terms of the natural environment. Those are very attractive principles. The Buddhist culture has also given us an identity, a physical identity, an artistic identity, and by showing our identity clearly, it also strengthens our sovereignty and our independence.
Yeah. Maybe you can explain a little bit more what it means in Bhutan as a reference point. Is it a goal, purpose?
I think at this stage, more than any kind of planning tool, in terms of, there is no parameter such as, we in economics we would say we had 6% economic growth, or that you're big tiger in doing 9% consistently GDP growth. It is not any planning tool in that sense, and we had never really looked at it that way. Also, I would say that we looked at it more as a sort of a guiding principle that should continuously remind us in our development and planning process that there are things that we shouldn't lose sight of. Mm-hmm. There are values that we should continue to look at.
But maybe I can turn to Karma Ura for a moment. Perhaps it is useful to explain a little bit the relationship between Buddhism and happiness. That might not be understood by a lot of people. How important is happiness for the Buddhist?
Well, at least in the language that we use in Bhutan, and that is from where even GNH is equivalence in Dzongkhai is drawn. Kaki and Prism Sokpe, Chekhov, you see, the nation who would be aspiring to be accomplished in terms of comfort, in terms of happiness. You know. But in the wider sort of scriptural language of Himalayas, Choke, as you know, you also constantly sort of this word recurs, this word deva. And deva is indeed happiness, But then in Buddhism, as you would very much be aware, there's a another focus on happiness. And that is very much to do with the notion of what is education in Buddhist terms. And that educational process is very much making yourself very much aware of the nature of yourself, what drives you. And in that sense, the understanding of this so-called basic negative emotions in Buddhism is very pertinent.
Okay, thank you. Now I'd like to turn to Professor Fainhof. We talk about happiness here in the Buddhist culture of Bhutan. It seems to mean a lot for the local people there. You've spent many years researching happiness from a sociological perspective. How do you define happiness?
Well, we need a bed, we need a meal, we need shelter. But once we have a reasonable standard of living, more material affluence doesn't really add to happiness in the sense of enjoyment of life. So I think Bhutan has a point here. Development, okay, we should escape poverty, but there's no need to be as rich as the Americans are. And if you look at American society, then you see that even the Americans don't profit from their enormous growth in wealth. And they are now twice as wealthy as they were 30 years ago, but they are still about equally happy.
How do you measure happiness?
Well, simply by asking a lot of people how happy they are. If you take a random sample, you know about how happy the average citizen is in a country. And if you do that a year later, you can see whether there is any improvement. And this kind of happiness research also shows where the optimum is. And in particular, in the case of growing wealth, we ask, well, should we add more and more wealth? I just told you that the American tripled their wealth and they didn't become any happier. Now, this research shows that there is really a saturation point at about $10,000 income per head. Until that level, happiness rises. After, extra wealth doesn't really add to happiness.
What is the Bhutanese situation? You reach that, or you hope to reach that in some time, or?
Well, if that is the measure for people to be happy, then we will not reach it for a very long time. Right now, in Bhutan, the per capita income level is calculated at about $650. We have not taken a sort of a econometric approach to. In fact, some of the best decisions we have taken was. We sort of worked out what the requirement might be and said maybe double it or triple it, and that would be worked out fine. And
yes.
It's always worked out fine.
Yes, intuition. Yes.
Yes. Coming back to the benchmark, the 10,000 figure, it essentially would mean that out of the 6 billion people or so, almost 5 billion people are not happy.
No, but yes. Now we leave it.
Now,
it is the saturation point, the point where extra
yes.
income doesn't add
okay.
any more
okay,
to happiness,
okay.
but it doesn't
yes.
mean that you
okay.
need $10,000 to be happy.
Yes. If so actually we are way too rich in our countries. It's correct. We have so we're wasting our energy making money. We could actually should give away till we are at the average and then we are just as happy. Is that correct?
Yes, I think we could do with a lot less and with a lot less damage to the environment. Yes.
When I hear you talking, I hear you saying, we want development, but we want development without losing social, contextual, and ecological cement by preserving our Buddhist values. Huh? That's a collective aim called the concept of gross national happiness. Huh? I hear you saying that there's a parallel between the national Bhutanese development and an individual level personal development. If you take an average Westerner, he or she has the idea that once you reach material wealth, that it's the main road to happiness. I think that happiness is a typical Western product and a typical Western thing to want to get. We are obsessed with happiness. What I find interesting about Buddhism is that it says if you want to achieve happiness, you can only achieve it by the paradox of not wanting it any longer. So that's very contradictory to how we normally perceive it in the West.
I think that is probably one of the merits, if I may say that, of GNH, because it suddenly addresses us to the question of really some sort of equilibrium at an individual level or at a societal level. Say, for example, the structural elements as specified in cross-national happiness are these four pillars, you know, culture maintenance, environment preservation, economic, socio-economic growth, and good governance. I mean, these are sort of pillars of good governance in the architecture of achieving happiness, you see. What this invites our attention to the fact that one may not sacrifice one component against other. You know, for example, environments to be sacrificed against this sort of goal of socio-economic development in income generation. Likewise, I suppose the cultural component, the heart of it is here, that we must breed a sense of sufficiency in ourselves. To me, the most interesting thing about this is the intersection between these pillars, you know, finding the core where we will become very stable, the people will become stable, the society as a whole will be stable in the sense that it is not caught in the runaway process of growth, more growth.
Would you say that hearing about Bhutan, will that country, is that country on the right road, in the right direction? Will it lead to more happiness if you take into account Bhutan's relatively cautious approach with democratization and opening up to globalized economy and like internet, things like that? Do you think that is a recipe for more happiness?
There is the general idea that modernization brings individualization, and that in individualization people get lost and get unhappy. That's the negative theory. But there is also another theory that says, well, in individualized society, people can make their own choices, and then they make better fitting choices and they get happier. Yeah, both plausible stories. And, well, what research shows is that, at least in the long run, individualism breeds higher happiness.
I wonder whether happiness is that much important. Let me put it another way. There is, in cross-cultural psychology and psychiatry, there's a very strong notion that when you look at Western psychology or the Western mind in general, that happiness is very much a foreground notion of what we think is important in life. Mm. I think that in your discourse, you say that individualism is a very important issue in being happy. But I think, again, that individualism is a very Western concept. When we look at how in certain Asian cultures, how the ego is perceived, the ego and the self has a completely different notion in those cultures than what it has in the West. We raise our children from the beginning that you have to take care of your own, that you have to be assertive, that you have to get individualized, that you have to interiorize your norms. Whereas in those cultures, you can say there is a kind of a core issue which is related to the self, which is even reflected in religious thinking like in Buddhism or Hinduism. But then in addition to that ego, the way we have it, there is a kind of a whole aura around it which has to do with a group consciousness, which is kind of part of your ego.
I agree that there are slight differences in appreciation. Indeed, in some Asian countries, being happy is not valued so much as it is in Europe. But still, it's experienced the same way. We see the same thing with health. Not all cultures evaluate health equally much, but they can be unhealthy like anybody.
But you would say that in all cultures in the world, happiness is a a purpose in life? Is that what people live
for? No, it's recognized. People know whether they are happy or not.
So what do people live for? What is the purpose then? It's not happiness then, because I ask because for Bhutan is so important in their overall development.
Well, when happiness is the gross national happiness is the policy goal, that doesn't mean that it's the individual's goal. You can have a society which gives people meaningful tasks and meaningful relations, and if they live there, they will feel happy without saying every morning, my task this day is to get happier. No, mostly if you pursue happiness as a goal, that's an empty goal. Typically, we feel happy when we are involved in work, in relations, in spiritual things, and the process of being busy and being involved, that's what makes us happy.
Material conditions through technological progress, socio-economic advancements may go on and on, but from the point of view of Deva or happiness, it is not something to be extremely odd, you know, of this sort of achievements. Indeed, I think some kind of that sort of top experience which you mentioned, some sort of peak experience, some sort of sudden burst in joy, and then fall, you know, trough and peaks, are positively, it seems to me, somewhat harmful. Our aim should be to maintain a steady level of contentment, you see.
I think in those cultures, I question whether that freedom that we try to get in the West, I wonder whether it's the same freedom as the freedom we are talking about. And I think that a lot of this freedom, you could even say, when you take the cultures where freedom is most advanced and where most money is, which may be good for an economic process, they lose their social network, they're unhappy. So I think these are conflicting values, and I think it's dangerous to superimpose something which is core in our mind and which is not important at all in Buddhism. Happiness is not important in Buddhism in itself.
I think it is. I mean, there are different books, different traditions in Buddhism. But as you stated clearly, the absence of disturbing states of mind.
Oh, but that's not happiness.
That leads to happiness.
No, absolutely. Enlightenment is what he said in the beginning. He said enlightenment has a different notion of happiness than we in the West talk about happiness. Is that what you said?
Would you say the ultimate purpose of Buddhism is to reach happiness? And traditionally, it is believed enlightenment or liberation is the ultimate state. Happiness would be the same?
It is a different kind of happiness. I mean, one cannot make easy comparisons with the kind of happiness, the ordinary kind of conception of happiness versus the kind of happiness that Buddhism analyzes, you see. The one is, the Buddhist kind is to be achieved primarily by more or less annihilating those mental states which one considers as negative, you know. And the other one does not discuss very much about that. Of course, there are a little bit of common elements in the ordinary and the Buddhist conception of overcoming negative emotion and therefore releasing yourself from tension, anxieties that are imposed by this kind of things. So in that sense, I think what I suppose in modern clinical and other terms are called neurosis and anxieties is outcome of negative emotions.
We talk about policy development, and we have to make choices, right? What's the driving motivation? Maybe you said.
Also,
yeah, you like.
I certainly think that call it joy, call it happiness, call it contentment. I mean, call it a high level of satisfaction. I think that is a goal of an individual. It is a goal of individuals, which then make up communities, and for that there are minimum conditions, as I agree. Certainly nobody should be hungry, or certainly nobody should be that ill. I think those aspects are important. Mm.
So what we have tried to say and done is, this whole thing is important. I mean, to reach a state of contentment, to reach a state of harmony. I mean, if you don't use the word happiness, I mean, perhaps we could have used any other word. But I think we have to accept that that there is a need for people to take away suffering in whatever form or shape it exists, whether it is in the mind, whether it is in terms of in a physical way.
Good. Well, thank you. Surely, gross national happiness is a unique concept, and I think you can be very encouraged by a lot of developments in modern economics, which I am seeing that many environmental economics, for instance, they criticize the traditional concept of gross national product. And institutions like the World Bank and UNDP, they develop their own indicators. You know, they move closely to the concept of gross national happiness.
You might say that the World Bank and the World Health Organization, they have developed a measure of unhappiness or of being unhealthy. And they call it almost like your measurement. How did you call your happiness?
Happy life years.
Happy life years. Now, the World Bank and the World Health Organization, they use disability-adjusted life years. And they, you might say it's a very complex mathematic thing, but you might say one daily is equal to 1 year of healthy life lost. So each year of healthy life lost is a daily. And they calculated for all the diseases, it's a series of books like this, they calculate for each and every disease what causes a high amount of dailies. They found out, first of all, that mental health is 15% of all the dailies, and with behavior-related illness, it's 45%. It's only 2.5% for malaria, it's only 5.6% for cancer, it's only 4% for tuberculosis and leprosy. So what you see then is that mental health is very important in that, but the depression is the most costly disease worldwide. So we talk about happiness. The contrary of happiness is, for every big company, for every nation state anywhere in the world, in economic terms, in social terms, in terms of human suffering, depression is the most costly disease. It's top one all over the world.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
And I would like to add here that this really illustrates one of the oldest sort of statement of Buddhism, that somehow even when we have $20,000 worth of living conditions around us, that one is not really in an unshakable position as far as happiness is concerned. That one is always, there is a sense of fragility in life, of course. Mm-hmm. There's accidents can occur, things can go wrong. And that unless there is a presence of some sort of some kind of fear, some kind of anxiety about how this happy condition can be perpetuated, you know, how it might be perpetuated. This is ever present in our life.
What often puzzles me is that on the one hand, you want to be detached and not worry so much about your money and things like that. On the other hand, as a person, you want to advance your life.
Yeah.
As a nation, as Bhutan, you want to advance the development of your country. When do I have to lean back and be detached and accept life as it is and take it for granted and be satisfied with what I have?
A lot of people think that Buddhism is merely detachment and taking a distance and retiring into a cave and doing meditation for the rest. That, I mean, my understanding from Buddhism, and I'm sure you agree, is actually quite the opposite. That you realize the reality of nature, and there is no real self to, you know, to withdraw in. And we're actually interconnected beings, and automatically, therefore, we have responsibility for our surroundings. So we're actually forced into action. So there is no real sense of detachment in that sense. It's detachment from objects that make you unhappy. But if you want to reach enlightenment, I mean, you are
in the study show that just makes people happier.
Yeah.
Because if it makes them involved in work, in relationships, then they feel good.
Yes. Yeah, but it's a good attachment, but you don't reach it as long as you stay attached to it. And you also say...
But you define detachment then.
You said something like you realize that the self is an illusion. Hmm? That's what you hinted at when you talk about Buddhism. But happiness is very much an illusion of the self. So that's why
it's still an experience. It is an experience.
Yeah, but it's also an illusion of the self. It's a very self-centered emotion. So that's why I said it looks
simple. Not necessarily. We can be very happy with the five of us talking here.
We can be happy without having a sense of self.
But he says happiness has to do with a sustained individual feeling. Okay, that's important. But not on all levels and not to every extent. Mm-hmm. So again, it's like with the income. Where's the limit?
Yes.
Where's the wisdom?
Our Dutch approach is sometimes a little bit of a cultural legacy of that happiness is not something you really deserve. I think that's particularly the Protestant ethic.
Right.
It's like the concept of original sin, and you have to work, and only after, you know.
I think that Protestant concept is quite close to Buddhism. I think it's very close to Protestantism, because in Buddhism there's a high degree of predestination, like in Protestantism, but still you can do something on your faith. So the freedom is larger because you can work on your karma.
Buddhism did what Holland didn't. In the late 1960s, in Holland there was also a movement which said we shouldn't focus on wealth, but also on well-being. And well, for quite some years that was a political slogan, but it died away, and the well-being was reduced to subsidized social work. But at the same time, the idea developed in Bhutan, and well, it remained. And I think that's a good thing. I wished well-being would be more prominent in Dutch social policy.
For a large part of our day, large part of our life, we are extremely preoccupied with many big causes, with many things to achieve, many things to pursue, you know, house, good families, careers, pursuing big causes and so forth. And we all do that partly because at the end of that road, we almost like a pot of gold, we want to like find happiness. Perhaps the route to happiness is just to give all of this up right from the beginning. Perhaps not to be preoccupied with finding happiness through these things, but to let them go. And perhaps we would spare ourselves that mad rush effort and have happiness, which is our goal anyway.
Sugandhem pushti vardhanam.